It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. With nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, you know what? It's time to wrap this summer thing up.
Don't you think so?
Yeah, whether you like it or not. It's about to happen. That's okay. We still have plenty of gardening. We still got plenty of gardening year. We're going to talk about how to manage all that. But right now we're going to talk about the end of summer. Finally, it's about to happen. It's amazing that people all over the state of Alabama, and I'm talking about from one end of the state to the other, are still harvesting tomatoes. Now, if you're in Mobile, that's kind of normal. You can do that if you've planted your tomatoes at the right time and you planted the right kind of tomatoes and you got them through July, etc., etc. It can happen because your first frost is not going to happen until typically last day of November, first few days of December. If you're in Huntsville, the idea that you would be still harvesting tomatoes, if you're in Birmingham, the idea that you would still be harvesting tomatoes this time of year is just kind of weird and something to think about. Something we all should think about. But it's there. It's here. And so we're going to talk about what to do with those last of those tomatoes, because that's what I'm doing. If you want to know, you almost caught me off guard here for this show, because I'm sitting here strolling through looking at green tomato pie recipes. Not that I need one necessarily. I just made something up yesterday. It's absolutely delicious. We'll talk about it. We'll talk about those green, and you can talk about it too. You know, the fried green tomato thing, yeah, it's kind of the, you know, it's kind of the cookbook thing, it's kind of the television show thing, and it's fine. It's a fine thing to do, but there's so many other cool things you can do with green tomatoes, and you're going to have a lot of them, and you're going to have a lot of tomatoes that are only part green and part ripe, and what do you do with those? Well, we're going to talk about that. It's cool. We're going to talk about cooking today a little bit. We're also going to talk about what to do here at the end of the season. Let's just talk about what you got, what you need to worry about, what you don't need to worry about. And we're going to have to talk about temperatures because we've got a big state. I don't know how cold it's going to be in Mobile. It's going to be cold, though. It's going to be cold. Probably, I would guess, around 32 degrees in most parts of Mobile County and Baldwin County this weekend. And it could last a while because we've got below normal temperatures going on for a while. Birmingham, it's definitely going to be below freezing coming up this weekend. Definitely. And we're not talking about frost. We're talking about below freezing. We've had a little bit of frost. We've had some days flirting with 32 degrees. But we're talking about temperatures probably around 28, 29 degrees around Birmingham, maybe colder going into the next week. In North Alabama, we're talking about temperatures in the mid-20s. Now, I'd rather this cold temperatures would kind of sneak up on us. That's ideal. And what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean by that is you want to have your plants gradually adjust to the cold. And we've had some cool temperatures. It is going to help. But just a few things to think about. And I would, if those of you on the Gulf Coast, let's go through. We're going to have some lists to go through. David Hubble's going to help us in the next hour when we're looking at things like melitons. But let's go through. On the Gulf Coast, if you have just planted a citrus this year, if you've just planted it, this is going to be one of those times when you really want to think about protecting that citrus. Now, older citrus should survive this just fine. I don't think there will be a problem. I don't think it's going to get that cold that they're going to be a problem. But young citrus are particularly vulnerable. And they could be particularly vulnerable because we haven't had any cold to kind of slow them down. So think about that. Think about, you may need to be protecting your citrus. You may need to do that. You know, even if you're in North Alabama and you don't have citrus, you may have some, you might want to walk around and check on some of your youngest charges, your youngest plants, your most recently planted blueberries, for example, and make sure they've gone dormant. They're normally pretty hardy. They're normally pretty hardy. But because of the drought and things like that, they may have kind of woken up with this rainfall recently, and they may be sprouting leaves, and they may want to be protected just a little bit through these first few freezes. You can call me. We'll talk about that. Here's something else you want to think about, particularly in, I think if you're in South Alabama and you've got vegetables, you want them to be exposed to this cold if they're winter vegetables. I don't think you need to struggle with your tomatoes and your peppers much longer. You can throw something over them if you want to, but the days are so short, you're not going to get a lot out of them. That's just the truth. But with your winter vegetables, you want to expose them to the cold. You want to expose them to this cold if you're on the coast, because they need this. They'll be great. Your parsley, your cabbages, your broccoli, your kale, your collards, your radishes, oh, your chard, what am I forgetting? There's a bunch of stuff like that. You can call me. You can ask me about specific plants. We'll talk about them. Let them, if you're on the coast, let them be exposed to this cold. That's neat. That is good. That is good for the plants. It's good for the flavor. It's good for you. Let them be exposed. As you move up towards Birmingham and Huntsville, if we get temperatures in the mid-20s, you need to start thinking about protection. Maybe even at 28 degrees in some cases. So if you've got some cabbages, I'd definitely throw something over them. If you've got broccoli, I would definitely throw something over them. We'll talk about what that something is and how to do it, but I'm just telling you, here's the list. Broccoli, cabbages, maybe even kale a little bit, just on this first frost. If it gets that cold on this first really cold spell, it'll survive most things. Your parsley's going to do okay. Your carrots are going to do okay. Your cauliflower needs to be covered. What am I missing? Oh, radishes. Some radishes won't manage it. So let's talk about those kinds of things and just covering them on this first frost. And just getting them through, because you want those broccoli to produce. Broccoli are a little different because they're producing flower heads, right? You're not eating the leaves. You're eating the flower heads. And those are pretty sensitive to cold. So we want to think about those. We want to think about those as we're coming up on this cold temperatures. And the other thing I would say as we're wrapping up this summer season, I hope, that you're not out there fertilizing. Heavens to Betsy. Don't fertilize this time of year, particularly with a quick release. You could probably get by putting cottonseed or something really slow out there. I think you'd be wasting your time doing that, but you could do that. But don't juice these plants up. You want your plants to go dormant. You want them to go quietly. You want them to sneak quietly into this cold, cool, slow season where things are going to be a lot slower. And that's okay. That's the way things should be. That's the way things should be. You know what? You're not through planting either. There's a lot of planting you can do, and we'll talk about how to do that. Just a wide range of things, even vegetables. Even vegetables. You're probably not going to get much to harvest between now and the end of December, but you might be surprised at what you can do if you plant now and get ready to pick in January, February, as those days lengthen. Lots to think about. The summer's over. I'm thinking about green tomato pies. I'm going to tell you what I did. You just stay tuned. It's pretty cool. Oh, boy, was it good. Made a few mistakes. Not that anybody else noticed their mistakes, but I could have done a little better, and we'll talk about that when we come back.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. We're thinking about the whole state. Yeah, the whole state's going to get a little bit colder. It's going to be colder. Folks, I hope we have the National Weather Service around for a long time. You don't know how important they are. You got a little app that says whatever it says. It says what it says because they're getting their information from the National Weather Service. Oh, boy, you don't know how important they are. And I'll also tell you, the National Weather Service isn't perfect. Nothing is. But I'm telling you, they know where they are. And they know what the local weather is. And they know when the they don't just allow an algorithm to tell them what's happening with the weather. That's the nice thing about having a local National Weather Service station. If you don't know what I mean is that there are models out there that say, oh, this is going to be this temperature here, this temperature there. But if you've got a great National Weather Service station locally, they can interpret that a little better, and they can make some adjustments, and they can offer some cautions. And that's something that some dude who's working out of an office in Kansas, oh, I won't say who that is, who's a private, working for a private, they can't do that. They don't have offices in these places. They don't know how to adjust. Sorry, we had to talk about that. We're going to talk about green tomato pie here in just a minute. But I want to talk about that because you don't know how important that National Weather Service office is. You don't know how important that data collection is. Don't let anybody take that from you. I'm just telling you, don't let anybody take that from you. It's very important to you. It's very important to you. And think about that when you're purchasing apps. It's fine. You get your little app. It's worth what it's worth. But think about the fact that most of those apps are based on what somebody in Kansas is telling you about your weather in Mobile, in Birmingham, in Huntsville. And I will tell you, the view from Kansas is limited. Steve, nothing wrong with Kansas. Not saying anything's wrong with Kansas. I'm just saying you can't see from Kansas to Alabama very well. Just by the way, hope you're hearing me. Support your local weather station. It's really important. Support the National Weather Service. It's incredibly important to what we do. It's incredibly important to our gardens, to our farms, to our lives. The National Weather Service, to get back on track, is telling us that they've got a 6 to 10 day and an 8 to 12 day or 8 to 14 day forecast. And not only do I see in the immediate forecast, which is very predictable, that we're going to have cold weather this weekend. It's what they're seeing, and I trust them to say that. They're also seeing that there's going to be a cold spell that's going to develop this coming weekend and spread through the next week. So that's what we're prepared for, and that's what we're thinking about, and that's what I'm trying to get you focused on. It's nice to know that we have those kind of tools, because you know, in the past, when we didn't have these kinds of tools, we just kind of had to guess what it was going to be like in a few days. But it's going to be colder. We don't have to guess. We can prepare for it. I don't say it's going to be exceptionally cold, but it is going to be exceptionally relatively cold. And what I mean by that is that we've had a lot of warm weather this year, and some plants aren't adjusting very well. So Carol in Huntsville is asking me, she said, there's a lot of blooms, a lot of things are blooming now. And she sends me pictures of lots of herbaceous plants, plants that aren't woody, plants like irises, plants like, some type of... can't tell. I'll have to blow the picture up. But several different types of plants that are blooming now and blooming much later than usual. Carol, let me tell you, in Mobile, those kinds of plants often rebloom in fall. Not irises, not that iris you showed me so much, but it can in South Alabama. It often does. Roses are blooming at their peak right now, in many places in South Alabama. Doesn't mean they won't bloom next year at all. A lot of these plants need a little bit of quiet. They need a little bit of quiet during winter to reset, but they may not need a long winter to reset. And for herbaceous plants that are out of their element anyway, I mean, a lot of these plants I'm looking at are basically Mediterranean or Asian plants that just are, I mean, they have a hard time adjusting to Alabama's climate anyway. I mean, they don't really know where they are. They don't really know what the season should be, and their seasons and their places don't look anything like our seasons anyway. Those are not going to be affected at all. They should be just fine. Because we've had such a long growing season, they may have used up a little more nitrogen than usual, and you may have to add more nitrogen next year. Maybe. And you could probably just about do it with some good mulching techniques. But no, I don't think you'll have any problem with those herbaceous plants. They are not exhausting themselves. They're still doing photosynthesis. They're still getting all that extra energy into their root system. That's really important, right? That's where it all comes from. They had extra photosynthesis to spare, and so they flowered. That's okay. That's all right. They'll still do fine. Some shrubs and trees may have a little bit more problem if they're blooming now. I don't see a lot of really dramatic bloom, but we are definitely seeing some apples and other trees wanting to bloom this time of year. The thing I worry about most with those is that they won't go into dormancy quickly. And there may be a little bit of tip damage, and it may be could be an entry point for diseases and other things because they weren't properly hardened off. But you're okay. We're okay generally. I think things, I don't see a huge bloom out right now. Azaleas, that's interesting. We always say, boy, the best bloom in spring for the old Southern Indian azaleas, which, oh, heavens to Betsy, people in even in Mobile aren't well-informed enough to have any more. With those Southern Indian azaleas, we kind of wanted a winter that they didn't have a lot of excess bloom during winter, and we knew we'd get a big bloom in spring as a result, usually. But generally speaking, there was always a trickle of bloom throughout the winter, even on those. So, no, I don't think you're going to see any problem with this little bit of bloom out. I don't think it's going to make a lot of difference for a lot of plants. The one thing that will make a difference is how many hours of cold temperatures we have this winter. And Carol, for a lot of trees and shrubs in, well, folks from trees and shrubs basically north of Mobile, though, that's going to be really important. Because if they don't get enough chill hours, we're not going to have another good, we're going to have another year with a bad peach crop. We're going to have another, we'll have bad apple crops because they're not getting enough chill. So we want enough chill, and we could still do it. We could still do it just fine during the winter if it's a moderately normal winter. It's getting harder to define what a moderately normal winter looks like. But if it doesn't stay too warm, we could have good crops. So it's those chill hours this winter, later this winter, that are going to be far more important. And that's it. So let's hope for a stable, continuously cool winter that doesn't have a lot of hot spells, has a lot of temperatures around 40 degrees. That's kind of the ideal temperature for accumulating chilling hours. We want to, that's what we hope for, and that's what's going to make a big difference in how things bloom next year. Oh, all this talking, I didn't talk yet about green tomatoes, which I swore I was going to do. Listen, Let me tell you, we just said this. You're going to have lots of tomatoes, and they're going to be in various stages of ripeness. Some of them are going to be green. Some of them are going to be green with a little red. Some of them are going to be green with a little yellow. It's okay. Those are great for making so many things. Last year, and I can't even remember what I did. I had to ask my wife what I did, but it was so good. We made greens, and I made a relish that I cooked with the greens out of green tomatoes. And it was absolutely delicious. That tanginess with the greens, I think it was probably, it could have been a mixture of radish and kale greens, whatever. It was delicious. It was great. I remember it distinctly. I added a few other things. Do I fry them? No, I just cut them up. And they're delicious. You just think of them as like a, it's like a vegetable that's functioning as a spice. And they're so good. They're so delicious. Acidanthera, thank you. Acidanthera. Thank you. Carol, for telling me what her plant was. It's really easy to use those green tomatoes, those late tomatoes. Just cook them. They're really good. They're going to add a little bit of tang, a little bit of spice. They don't all have to be perfectly green. They don't all have to be perfectly ripe. It's fun to just mix and match. They're fine. They're all going to be good. What I did with the tomato pie... The first thing I did with a tomato pie, how do I put this, is to live with a woman who's very good at making pastry. Right? So you roll it out. I could do this too, but I'm not that good at it. I will just say I'm not that good at pastries. Roll it, you know, you get all that, put it in your pie pan. If you want to go to the store and get you one of them pre-manufactured pie dough crust, you can. So we're getting to the first stage. As soon as we get back, we're going to get to the next stages.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Questions on conservation, natural history, and gardening? Talk with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Key says following him is like following a coon dog. sort of, Keith. You know, it's the different kinds of coon dogs. There's some coon dogs who follow any scent that catches their fancy. And they ain't worth two. And maybe I'm one of them kind of coon dogs. Ultimately, though, we're going to stay on scent here. Because we were talking about green tomatoes. And I said we were going to talk about green tomatoes. We were talking about lots of other things. But they had to talk about the weather, all that. But we're talking about green tomato pie. Listen, it's fun to use those green tomatoes. Don't feel like you have to fry them. You got plenty of recipes for frying them. And if you want to fry them, you just go right ahead. That's fine. You don't have to dough them up, though. You don't have to put all that stuff on them. Just make a pie. And I think a deep dish pie is good. Not too deep, but just a little deeper. However, it's fine. Just put your dough in there. Come back with, and then you can just start layering. What I did was I had some silver chard. And it was looking pretty. And it was getting cool enough that it was getting good flavor. And chard has a great flavor. Great flavor. So I had some silver chard. It's producing really well. Actually, I planted it last spring. And it managed to survive the summer. Came back up. Doing great. Silver chard. Picked some of that. Cooked it with a little bit of peppers and greens. Peppers and onions and garlic. Had some help on that. Just stir frying that. It was really good. Didn't use a lot of oil. Don't need to use a lot of oil. In fact, you can put those greens in a black skillet. Just get them a little, get a little toasty. Just use a little bit of oil if you like. Just a little bit. Stir fry that. Put your tomatoes in. I put a little mozzarella. I put the first layer of tomatoes in. Let me tell you about that first layer of tomatoes. That first layer of tomatoes was a mixture of semi-ripe tomatoes and green tomatoes, and some of the tomatoes were half and half. I probably wish in the bottom I would have put a layer of green tomatoes, just green tomatoes in the bottom. And the reason is those semi-ripe tomatoes are going to be a little moister, okay? But just green tomatoes in the bottom. I put some mozzarella right over that. Just some dabs of mozzarella. Just dabbed it in there. Put it across the top. Put that chard and that chard mixture right on top of that. Then I came back with another layer of tomatoes. And that layer of tomatoes could be a mixture of, if I were doing it right, I would have that be a mixture of some of the semi-ripe and the green tomatoes. And they're going to melt down, bring a little bit of moistness to it. Just put another layer there. These are sliced. You can put a little salt and pepper as you go. Going to be plenty of flavor. You don't need to add a whole lot of other weird stuff. And then I came back with another layer of greens. And on top of that, and greens, and I shred a little bit of Parmesan cheese or Romano cheese over that, whichever you prefer, and some parsley on that layer. Then the last layer, tomatoes. The last layer should be tomatoes because they stand up to toasting real well, and that last layer can be whatever, you know, it can be ripe or semi-ripe or very green tomatoes, just a mixture on the top. They'll do really well on top. Sprinkle it with a little more Romano or Parmesan, you know, shred it off. And then, as it's just about to finish cooking, go ahead and put you some more parsley, fresh parsley on the top. Boy, was it good. Boy, was it good. Peppers can be important if you like that sort of thing. Be thinking about what kind of peppers you want to use. Could you use mushrooms in there? I think you could, but I actually don't think it needed it. I don't think it needed it. You could put bacon in there, and you know what? You're going to ruin all the other flavors. It's going to taste like bacon. Just you know, cook some bacon fat, drink the bacon fat. There you go. I wouldn't add bacon to this. It doesn't need it. It's really, the chard has got great flavor. Lots of other, kale would have great flavor too. I think I prefer the chard. It's right there on the top of my list. There it is. So that's this green tomato pie. The top is going to get toastier while the bottom's still cooking. How it's, you know, I don't know. It was 375. We just make it up as we go along. 375 for however long it takes. 30 minutes, 25 minutes, 30 minutes. The top's going to get toastier. So that's why having those tomatoes on top, and you can sprinkle some Romano on there, and it's all fine. That'll toast and look really pretty. If you put your greens on top, they get a little too toasty, I find. A little too toasty. And again, a little bit of oil. Now, I've seen people put mayonnaise. Mayonnaise? How you say that? Somebody say it for me. Mayonnaise. On top. In the middle. And it don't need it. Can I just say, it don't need it. You got a lot of other good flavors going on there. The tomatoes are going to have plenty of juice. You're going to have the mozzarella. I like the mozzarella. It's not too strong. It doesn't take away from the other flavors, but it definitely adds some substance to it. It's good. Just a thought. You tell me what you would do. You tell me what you would do. All right. There we go. What other questions we got this morning? Santiago tomatoes in a pot, still producing tasty tomatoes. You know, I've basically had three tomatoes this year. Next year, I will probably have two types of tomatoes. And one type is simply because it's a big tomato, yellow tomato, that my wife likes a lot. It's Kellogg's breakfast. And it's surprisingly stalwart for a yellow tomato. Surprisingly stalwart for a yellow tomato. And it's holds up well. So it's a good one. But Santiago, boy, howdy, what a great tomato. What a great flavor. What a great cooking tomato. What a great fresh-eating tomato. Really good, that Santiago tomato. I got it from a long time ago from Tomato Fest in California. It's basically really an old-fashioned tomato. It's a tomato from where tomatoes come from in Central America. And it's really delicious. Smaller, but really, really ornate, and really the flavor just can't be beat. And it can't be beat for cooking, too. I didn't have as many of those green, but we had a few green ones in there from that, and they were absolutely delicious. So, yeah, what a great tomato Santiago is. It's one of those tomatoes that will actually make it through July on the Gulf Coast. And I used to say there weren't tomatoes that make it through July, but that was before I began to understand what attributes in tomatoes I was looking for to make it through July. And definitely a lot of these smaller, old-fashioned tomatoes, not the German tomatoes, not the Amish tomatoes, not the New England tomatoes, not the big tomatoes, not any of the, I'm talking about the old tomatoes that basically have a lot of that Central and South American heritage still intact. And a lot of cherry tomatoes do really well through the summer, and you'll be picking them still through midsummer and into fall. But Santiago does well all throughout the state. Really a great tomato. All right, let's see what else we got. I got the feeling when you start cooking, you're going on an adventure. Well, if you're not, what's the point? I have a lot of recipe books for various reasons. I probably used them at one time. I never even think about using a recipe book when I have a garden, because the garden is always telling me what it is I should be putting into what I'm cooking. And the garden is always right. Because it's the fresh stuff that you want to put in there. It's not what some cookbook says you got to put in your food. It's because that means it's coming out of a grocery store. It's your garden telling you what needs to go into a dish. Oh, David Hubble knows I'm going to talk about, what do they call it? The Holy Trinity, the Trinity of Creole food. That's ridiculous. That's the grocery store Trinity. It's what your garden tells you to put into your Creole food. It's what your garden tells you to put into your Mobile food and your Huntsville food and your Birmingham food. And you listen to your garden. And your garden's going to make everything taste good. Everything tastes good. The little refinement, but the garden makes everything taste good if you pay attention to what's fresh, what's coming out, how to use it fresh. Do you think it's too late to plant shrubs and trees? Absolutely not. Under no circumstance, Ellen. Absolutely not. You go right ahead. I don't think it'll be any problem. I would not plant citrus. That's the only one. All right. So have we got a callers? Is that what I'm hearing, Steve?
Yes, sir. You have, I believe, Paul in Grand Bay.
Steve, we got a caller?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, good, good. Who am I talking with?
You're talking with Paul from Grand Bay.
The guy. Paul, I'm listening. What's up? Yeah.
Bill, I got a couple banana trees. And
yes, sir.
They're young banana trees. We've only had them about a year or two. And it's got some bananas on there on different stalks. And they're about 2-3 inches long. But I've noticed the banana trees are going, I guess, dormant. You know, where the leaves start turning brown and falling, and the little lighter stalks are falling. Is it okay to go ahead and just cut them bananas off? Because they don't keep perpetuating through winter, do they?
Okay, so a lot of different implications there. The bananas that you've got, if they're still, when did they first emerge? When did those bananas, the banana fruits, when did those banana fruits emerge? Do you remember?
Oh, man, yeah, a couple months ago. They come on. Bill ain't big as a pencil, and yeah, there's only about like 15 on. But then I got a couple of little stalks that are big as your thumb, but only 2 or 3 inches long.
Yeah, Paul, those are not going to ripen.
Still green.
Those are not going to ripen. What? Those will not ripen. So no need in worrying about those. Now, those stalks that produce those bananas will not produce bananas next year. So there's no need to try to protect those stalks or keep those stalks. What you really want to work on for next year, if you want bananas, if you want the fruit,
right,
the banana clump is going to be fine. You ain't got to worry about that. You'll still have sprouts no matter what. But if you want fruit next year, what you want are the stalks that are right now about chest high to head high. And you want to protect those through the winter. They're the ones that are going to make your bananas next year. Even if they lose leaves. So hold on, Paul. I got to do this break, but as soon as
you
come back,
we'll
talk a little bit about this. You hang on, because we're going to talk about it a little more.
Welcome back to Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with Bill Finch. Ask Bill about gardening and nature in your backyard. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Hey, folks. Welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Alabama Sunday morning. Talking about lots of things, getting ready, putting an end to this summer. It's about the end for all of us. It's been a long summer. It's been a long summer. It's been a long, long period of warm weather, exceptionally warm weather. But now, and pretty much on schedule, we're getting the temperatures we should be getting. Some of us, because we didn't have earlier frost, have a little more to worry about. We'll talk more about that in our next hour. But, you know, this is a great time to talk about bananas, Paul. And I'm glad you brought it up, because you will, with these first frosts, you're going to start seeing leaves turning brown, getting a little punky looking. Not all the leaves, but some of them. And if it's real cold, you're going to lose all of your leaves. But it doesn't mean that the trunk is bad. Listen, it doesn't mean, Paul, that the trunk is bad. That trunk, even if it doesn't have leaves, will resprout next year, as long as it hasn't produced bananas before. It'll resprout next year, and it'll resprout pretty early, and that means you're going to have a big leg up on producing bananas next year. So what you want is to carry over a trunk that's about 6 or 7 feet tall. Well, 5 to 7 feet tall. No taller than that.
Okay, I got a
bunch of those.
Pretty good many of them coming up. Out of one.
Yeah, that's right. You know, so that's good. And all those, just leave them all. No need to cut any of those back. In fact, there's really no need to even cut back the stalks that have fruit on them right now. They'll offer a little bit of protection to the other stalks coming up underneath them. And just save those stalks that are about 5 to 7 feet tall. Be sure to save those and protect them if you like.
That. Well, yeah. That's what I've always heard you say.
The ones that are taller are going to be harder to protect, and they're not. You want that banana to start fruiting sometime in May, June, or July. If it's really late May, June, and July, if it starts fruiting a lot earlier, for various reasons, those bananas are not going to be as good. But mostly you want the stalks that are, that's why I say, about 5 to 7 feet tall. Don't even worry about the taller ones. And then next spring, Paul, one more thing. Next spring, be sure to cut back all but 2 or 3 of those 5 to 7 foot stalks.
Okay,
cut them all back once
going.
The frosts are done. Yeah.
Because I've listened to you for years, and you would tell people, you know, like, pile leaves up around them to keep them, you know, the main root stock or whatever, warm through the winter. But I didn't know, I forgot about you know, I know I ain't supposed to cut it all the way back to the ground, but like you said, the real tall ones, just cut it down and just leave the ones that's 5 to 6 foot tall. Or what about this? What if it's got a discoloration, you know, where it's kind of brownish black going to the bottom? Do I cut that down and just keep the fresh, greener ones?
Okay. Right now, you don't have to cut down anything.
Okay.
Just wait till spring. Wait till spring. No need to cut down anything now. The only reason you have to cut anything down is because the person you live with says, oh, I can't stand the look of those brown leaves anymore. You have to cut it down.
Hey,
but that's not good for the banana. That's just good for your living conditions at home. So, So here's the thing. If you want to trim off the leaves once they get, you know, once they get brown looking, but don't cut back the stalks. And then this, okay, in the spring, you pick the two or three nicest looking trunks you've got that are about 5 to 7 feet tall and leave those, cut out all the rest. And I wouldn't, and just leave those and then fertilize them. We'll talk about that. You'll call me back in spring. I don't want to put too much on you right now. Just spring.
Right.
If you want to, you can, and let me clarify for people what we do with leaves. So if you put leaves only on the ground to protect the roots, you're not doing anything to help get banana fruits.
Put on the
because
outside.
What you want to do is you want to protect the trunk with the leaves.
Right.
And to do that, I found the best way to do it is with leaf bags full of leaves. That actually helps.
Oh, you mean fill the leaf bags full of leaves and put the bags against
the trunk?
The trunk?
Yeah.
Okay.
And,
okay.
And that makes a lot, that makes, you know, if you can, if you don't mind the look of it, and the person you live with doesn't mind the look of it, it's a great way to protect those trunks. And
she'll get over it.
Yeah, so, and the reason is if you were just to only put the leaves on the ground, you would just be protecting the roots, which don't need protecting. And you're also going to mean that any heat that might come out of the ground, you're basically keeping it from coming out of the ground and keeping the top warm. So what we want to do is we want to keep that, we want to keep the stalk warm through the winter. If we have a mild winter, it won't matter if you do that or not, if in Mobile. It won't matter. You'll still get bananas anyway. But if we have a slightly colder winter temperatures, then it becomes a problem.
Okay. Let me ask you this. You just said about the bananas coming on in like June or July or late May or whatever. Or is bananas like any other fruit or vegetable, you know, where they got 60 days to fruit or 100 days, let's say, for pumpkins or whatever? Do they grow, is it extended a long time? And then you know whether it's going, if they're coming on, is there a set date, like, you know, after
yes,
120
yes,
days it should be done?
Yes,
you know?
Yes, 90 to 120 days. So
okay.
once you see that fruit come out of the stalk, come out of the trunk, out of the stalk,
right.
Once you see that happening, it's going to be about 90 to 120 days before you have bananas. And so that's
okay.
Why I say it's really important to have, if you can get fruiting before the middle of August, you can stand a good chance of getting ripe bananas on the Gulf Coast. So you want to see that fruit emerge, and then it'll be 90 to 120 days later. And generally 120, that's excessive. It's going to be 90 to 100 days later. When it,
okay, I just
when
didn't
it,
know.
At that point, yeah, at that point you can cut it off if you want to and bring it inside and let it ripen inside. So, which is what happens when you buy bananas from the grocery store.
Oh, yeah.
They pick them green and then they bring them inside to ripen. So it's, you need about 90 days after you see that fruit emerge. So be, you know, just observe when that happens.
Okay.
And, one other thing that is weird about bananas, and without confusing the issue too much, they don't They don't get pollinated. They don't even accept pollen. They don't need another banana. In fact, that's one of the problems with bananas, is that they're all basically, how do I describe this? It's all virgin birth, if I can say this.
Oh, yeah.
It means that they don't get any pollen. They don't have any sex. They don't, can I say that out loud? They don't do any of that kind of stuff. They have been bred so that they don't do that kind of stuff. So the fruits are actually emerging in the stalk. The fruits develop in the stalk and then emerge as fruits. It's weird. And that means if the stalk gets too cold when the fruit develops, the fruits get real stringy and they're not very good. That's why I'm saying, don't try to save a big trunk. You just want those 5 to 7 foot trunks, because the bigger trunks.
Can I ask you one quick question?
Well, we got to. I got to take
it's
a
got
break.
It's got some pretty flowers.
It's time for Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast with nationally recognized nature writer and award-winning horticulture and nature expert, Bill Finch. Bill shares his knowledge of conservation, natural history, and gardening. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with your personal garden and nature consultant. Here's Bill Finch on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, welcome back. It's Gulf Coast Sunday mornings in Alabama Sunday morning. I'm still thinking about that green tomato pie. It was good. I got it. I know exactly how I would do it now. And I kind of gave you those directions. I didn't give you the one other direction that I need to tell you about with that mozzarella cheese in there. In fact, with any cheese in there. You want to let it cool off just a little bit before you try to cut it. Otherwise, you cut it too soon, cheese is going to go string everywhere. You don't want that. You want to cool just a little bit. Yeah, but it was good. It was awful good. You don't need to, you know, you don't need to put somebody taught me how to say it. Who was it? Send me a message about how I'm supposed to say mayonnaise. You don't need to put mayonnaise on it. You don't need to put Miracle Whip on it. You don't need that kind of stuff. It's really good. You want those tomato flavors to shine through. You can use a really stinky or a really strong cheese, but you don't want to lose those wonderful flavors that come from tomatoes. And what you're going to end up with, some ripe, some unripe tomatoes. And what's the difference? David wants me to talk a little bit about this. You know, what I mean by green tomatoes is they're just about all green. Now, there should be a lighter shade of green, preferably, but any shade of green's fine. It'll work. And then the immature tomatoes will have a little bit of color to them. They're okay, too. You can use those. I would not put those on the bottommost layer because they tend to get a little soggier. It's one thing to think about when you're doing this is how soggy is this mix going to get? How is it going to mess up my pastry? That's why you don't want to add a lot of water to it. And those greens, that's why I don't add a lot of oil to the greens either. You don't want them to be sloppy greens. You want them to be good greens, and a lot of different kinds of greens could work. And I use them as the layers in between, and they really just, I think chard was perfect. It was just perfect. But I think kale's going to work too, and I think lots of other greens can work. Have fun. Think about it. You let your garden tell you what you put in it. You always let your garden tell you. George, I know exactly what you're talking about. Tell me about what you saw. You there, George?
Yes, I am.
So you were down at the state docks, and you saw this thing, and it was just as prickly as it could possibly be.
Exactly, with little buds all over, full of spines, and then they show a little green tomato the size of a marble, and they turn real red, and they're full of seeds, and they fall off, and nothing will eat them.
Well, what you're looking at is Solanum sesembrifolium. Let me find a common name for that. It's a nightshade. It's one of the nightshades. I'm not sure which one. It's a tomato relative.
Yeah.
It is pretty invasive in certain habitats. And it is as prickly as it can be. And it is gets big. It gets really big.
Yeah, that describes it perfectly.
Yeah. Do you want to? You could grow it in your yard. There's no telling what the dust in the state docks has in it, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure I fully trust eating anything right off the state docks property. Don't tell anybody at state docks I said that. It grows wild down there all over the place. I've seen it many times. It's edible. It is actually quite good. It has the flavor of sour cherries and tomatoes all mixed in one. It's good. It's fine. You can eat it. I don't recommend eating anything off the property of the state docks, however. If you want to save the seeds and put them in your garden and let it and then you know, you can use it as a barrier to keep any neighbors from ever visiting you again.
Yeah.
So it's a pretty tough little plant, it will spread around if it's got bare soil.
Yeah, and I'm not interested in doing anything with it. It's just real invasive. It'll practically grow on a rock.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't grow as well if it doesn't have bare soil, and if it won't spread around. But any place you have bare soil, it's liable to come up if you plant it in your yard.
All right, I was just curious what it was.
Well, George, there it is. You gonna make me spell Sisembrifolia?
No, that's okay.
I can't. It's Sisymbrifolium, something like that. I've seen it down there many times. It's a foreign plant. It's an invasive plant, a little bit, but not as aggressive as some plants.
Okay, actually, everybody's got an opinion. People say they're poison. People say they're not. I've seen people eat them, and I was just curious what they were because they're sprouting up everywhere.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they're not toxic. They're okay to eat. All right.
Thank you very much.
Good to hear from you, George. There's so many fun things I want to talk about. We kind of started on all these this morning. Paul had some other questions. Paul, if you want to text them to me, I'll try to get to them. We had a great time talking about bananas. And one of the things I talked about with bananas, and I'm not, you know, if you're a serious banana person, you'll do this. If you're a serious, I want bananas every year. And I wanted bananas every year because I like bananas, and particularly homegrown bananas, which are inevitably infinitely better than any banana you're ever going to buy at the grocery store. I'm just telling you, they're incredible. We have a lot of great banana varieties, and we can talk about them that are grown along the Gulf Coast. Not a lot, but, well, two or three. And it's worth talking about all three of those, and we will in just a second. But if you want to have bananas every year, you got to keep some stalks going. And I went over that with Paul. Not the biggest stalks. In fact, the biggest stalks, you don't worry about them. This time of year, you don't want to worry about them. You want to worry about the stalks that are about 5 to 7 feet tall. What is a stalk? It's a trunk. Let's call it a trunk. And that's what you want to keep over the winter, and that's what's going to produce your bananas next spring. Having the biggest trunks is not the best thing to keep to overwinter. You can do it. You can leave them there, but they're not the ones that are going to produce the best fruit. Trust me. I've been through this a lot. But a lot of people protect their bananas with bags of leaves, and they do that because I started doing that, and I realized it worked pretty well. And it does seem to work well for a lot of people. And the bags of leaves are slightly better than just piling the leaves there because, one, you can't keep the leaves. If you don't have something to contain them in, they just kind of fall away, and it's the trunk you're trying to protect. B-Dark asked me, can you use those bags of leaves around young citrus? And you betcha. It is very useful around young citrus. they're probably less useful around older citrus, and I'll caveat that just. But young citrus, it's really good to protect them with those leaf bags. Let me tell you why leaf bags work. They're moist, and they break down while they're in the bags. And the warmth, and because you're keeping them in that bag, the warmth sort of, they sort of warm themselves, and they will start breaking down, and that warmth actually radiates from the bags. I know that sounds wild, but it's true. If you want to add a little bit of fertilizer to those bags, you can, in the form of cottonseed meal, in the form of just regular old fertilizer, whatever. Cottonseed meal is probably a little better, actually. And just mix it in. Doesn't take a lot. Just mix it in. Make sure it's a little moist, not sopping wet. Just a little moist. Just moist. And those bags are going to heat up really fast, and they will keep your trunk warmer. Now, and it'll probably radiate up into the crown a little bit as well. I think that's less useful if you have an older citrus. And with the older citrus, we don't really have to worry until temperatures get down to around 20 degrees, 18 degrees. We'll come back and talk about that. Let's talk about that a little later in the year. We don't need to worry about that right now. But it's the young citrus we do want to protect. Those leaf bags work well. We'll be back.
FM Talk 106.5 with Plain Living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Call 251-343-0106. Here again is your personal nature expert, Bill Finch.
All right. Lots of things to lots to deal with. I want to mention B-Dark, who had a question about using the leaf bags on her citrus. And B-Dark, again, the young citrus, I think it's great. Older citrus, a little more complicated. Let's don't deal with those right now because they're gonna survive this cold. But let's deal with that. Let's deal with what we do with older citrus a little later in the year. But young citrus, yes, those leaf bags can certainly help. B-Dark also sent me a very pertinent message, and this is very important for all of us. B-Dark says she uses green tomatoes in her pepper relish. That is so good. It's great. It's another way to use green tomatoes. Listen, green tomatoes, what a treat. And it's the end of the season. It's how we wrap it up, is thinking about ways to use ripe, semi-ripe, and unripe tomatoes. And all of us are going to have to be thinking about that, I can assure you, because of the temperature. What else we got? What is meant by leaf bag? What is meant by leaf bag? So there are these black plastic things, which are otherwise known as garbage bags. In fact, they may best be described as garbage bags. And which brand? It's whatever brand the people on your street are using, because what you do is you don't even bother with picking up leaves yourself. You just go and pick up you let your neighbors do it for you. You use whatever bags they have, preferably they're bags that don't have perfume in them. Boy, do I hate that. God, do I hate that. That is the worst stinkiness smell you can possibly imagine, is perfume garbage bags. There are a few smells that drive me crazier, but that's the worst. And you'll probably get a few perfumed garbage bags in there, but it's just black plastic bags that are full of leaves. The stuffier they are with leaves, the finer they are. You want to make sure they don't have a lot of other messy stuff in them, but, you know, it's whatever bags the leaves on your, the people are bagging their leaves up in. If they're, surely they're using plastic, which is what everybody else is using. Throw those bags away at the end of the season. And it's so much nicer when you don't have to buy your own bags and stuff them. You know, you just think, oh, I got such nice neighbors doing this for me. There you go. So somebody sent me a message about, I planted these bushes over a year ago, and they have not grown 1 inch. I'm sending you a photo of my cousin's Virginia yard and what they should look like. How can I make them grow? And the simplest answer is move to Virginia. There is this thing called climate. I know nobody wants to talk about it. But, you know, it exists. It's real. It's big. And it changes from place to place, among many other things. Changes from time to time and from millennia to millennia and sometimes from decade to decade, depending on how we're messing with things. So Virginia has a very different climate than Mobile has. And a lot of the cypress that are, you know, kind of the Home Depot, Walmart kind of stuff, don't grow well down here. And there are a lot of evergreens that do grow well down here. I wish we had better sources for them. We are letting Lowdown Depot determine what plants we grow, and that's always a problem. I think those are going to have a hard time. They are generally slow growing anyway, but in this case, in Mobile, they're going to have a tough time, assuming you're messaging me from Mobile. Actually, if you live in Birmingham or Huntsville, they'll do okay. They may do okay as far south as Montgomery or even in the Red Hills in some cases, but Mobile's tough for those kind of, I think that's probably Hinoki cypress, which is one of the easier ones, but it ain't easy. Not in our climate. So a lot of issues. Mary, Dave is going to be with us here in just a minute, but I wanted to, you had a question about angel's trumpets?
Yes.
So I'm listening.
Okay, the question is, a friend and I both have angel trumpets, and neither one of them produced flowers this year. And yet, I was driving around Fairhope and came upon this house that had the most gorgeous angel trumpets I've seen in a long time, big, beautiful ones. And I was bold enough to go up to the front door of the person whose house it was and ask them what they did to protect or fertilize their trumpet. We didn't do anything. And I said, well, where did you get your angel trumpet? Ordered it online. And so, I'm asking, what
Mary,
can I do to get mine to bloom?
So I have an important question for you, which is, where did you get your angel trumpet? And what
goodness
type
gracious,
of...
what I can answer neither one of those questions because I pick up plants on the street that people are throwing out and I think can be resurrected, and someone may have given it to me, and I can't answer for my friend either. But
yes, so...
it made it through the winter. I mean, it didn't die back or anything, and they're in pots now. They're in pots.
Yeah, well, I don't think the pots are an issue. So some types of there are a lot of different kinds of angel's trumpets out there. A lot of different types. There are some of the types that have more red in them are much more finicky and much harder to get to bloom.
Perhaps
it's possible,
that's the case.
It's possible you ended up with one of those.
Yes, it is possible.
How big is it?
I would say about 4 feet tall.
Yeah, so it's a little small. I think next year it'll probably do okay. Just make sure it has a big enough pot. I would say it's going to be very hard for you to find those red ones. They're not at all common on the Gulf Coast. I would say give yours another year to grow, and in the ground they need no attention whatsoever. I mean, they'll bloom as long as they're getting enough sunlight. They're going to bloom pretty regularly every year.
Take them out of the pot and plant them?
If you could leave them in a pot, and if you wanted to put them in a bigger pot, you could do that, and I think that'll help. But you could also take them out of the pot and put them in the ground, and they'll do just fine. Now,
okay.
do you Yeah, and I think even now, if you put them out, they'd be fine.
Okay.
Put them against a. If you can put them so they get a little protection, like on the east side of your house, that's kind of an ideal place. It's east or southeast side of your house is an ideal place for those angels' trumpets if you want them to be really, really big. And
east or southeast.
Yeah, so, you know, they get to be tree-like, and they have those flowers hanging all down, all around. That's really impressive. And you'll stand a better chance of keeping that trunk going if you put them on the east or southeast side of your house.
The one that I went up and asked about, the people were generous enough to give me a stalk, and I'm trying to propagate it, and it seems to be taking. I'm not sure, but...
I'm sure it will. They're pretty easy. They're pretty easy to do. Yeah. And I don't see any reason, unless you've got some of the really rare ones, like the red ones that are really finicky, I don't see any reason to grow them in pots. B-Dark tells me that they shouldn't be grown in pots. I think you probably could get them to flower in pots, but it won't make it any easier and it'll probably make it harder.
Good to know. Well, that's it on the today's question.
All right, Mary, good to hear from you. David, are you there? Are you there, David?
I'm here.
All right, good. David Hubble, I'm going to introduce him just in time for the ads to cut us off, and then we're going to come back. But David Hubble's here with us. David is the expert on Gulf Coast foodways. And from Louisiana back through Mississippi and Alabama along the Gulf Coast. And David's done a lot of research on all of them. But, of course, David is one of the experts nationally on growing melaton. And we're gonna talk about why we pronounce it that way. We're going to talk about the best way to pronounce it. We're going to talk about how you spell it. We're going to talk about what it is. And we're going to talk about his success with it this year. It's one of the great Gulf Coast food traditions, melaton. And we're going to be talking a little bit about that with David this morning. So want you all to stay tuned. We're going to be, let's see what else we, and David, we're also going to talk about your experience with green tomatoes. Do you have any?
Mm-hmm. Very limited, but
oh dear,
but we can talk about it.
David is always sending me recipes in the middle of the show that just inevitably make me really hungry. All right, we're gonna be back.
FM Talk 106.5, home for plain living for Alabama and the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106.
All right, we're going to be back here with David. I want to take care of business real quickly. B-Dark asked me, would it be good to put live oak leaves under her citrus tree? No, not now. You may do that if you like in spring. Don't do it now. And B-Dark, you call me, you make sure to pester me next week so we can talk about that. But no, do not mulch underneath your big citrus trees or your small citrus trees this time of year. Leaf bag's a different story. Do not mulch. And B-Dark, let's talk about that next week so people will make sure they understand that. But just, folks, trust me. Trust me on it. Let's see what else we got. I wish I could help on that Hinoki cypress situation with the golden cypress. A lot of them just don't like the heat of our summers, and they don't even deal well with the excess moisture. They're from northern Japan, I think, and they're evergreens, but they've been selected for in places where they just don't do quite as well down here. What else am I missing? It seems like, Johnny, your unhybridized azalea is very hard to propagate. Martin Vandergeesen, my good friend, knows how to do all that. And it's these are deciduous azaleas. Azaleas that lose their leaves, they're much harder than evergreen azaleas to propagate. Not impossible, but they take some thinking. I don't know. I don't think I could do it really well, just for example. Now, root cuttings is a different thing. We'll talk about that. Remind me to talk about that a little more next week. David, We need to tell folks what melitol is.
Well, usually I call around this time of year because melitol is one of our Gulf Coast treasures that we got from Mesoamerica. It's a vining member of the cucurbit family, and it's basically, you might know it in grocery stores as chayote or chayote squash, or a vegetable pear. And our varieties that we grow along the Gulf Coast, the vines can get to be 100 foot long and produce up to 100 fruit. And they're about 3/4 of a pound. They look like a pear, but they're greenish, and light greenish to even white in color. Some have little spikes and furrows on them. And you usually harvest them around mid-October to mid-November through all the way through January if you have a nice mild winter. And the reason they're so popular this time of year is because of their abundance, they become popular on your holiday tables. So you'll see stuffed melitol with crab meat and shrimp, melitol casserole with shrimp and crab meat as well on your Thanksgiving tables through your Christmas tables. So they've done real popular in New Orleans. It was believed they were brought in through the Haitian migration in the early 1800s. So they've been a staple out there for 200 plus years, and they've made their way over throughout the Gulf Coast. We got them growing here in Mobile, Florida, Panhandle, southern parts of Florida actually too, all the way up to the Texas coast. So they're pretty popular, but once you get too far north of, I guess you say, Montgomery, they become difficult to grow because they don't flower until you have the short days and long nights. And so they have both male and female flowers on the vine. And I'm forgetting a bunch of other stuff, but that's kind of it in a nutshell, an overview.
Yeah, and that's it. So, and David, we should say good to eat. So yeah. They're really pretty versatile. They're really very versatile, versatile vegetables, right?
Right. In fact, you can make baked goods with them. You can make sweet, savory dishes. As I mentioned, you have the dressings or the casseroles that are going to be on the savory side with your Trinity and your melitol pulp that you mix together. And then you can go in a couple of directions. Like I said, you can do the crab and shrimp, which makes an excellent top with some breadcrumbs, or you can do it maybe with Italian sausage if you want more of an Italian flair to the dish. Some people have done it with ham and cheese, just chopped ham and cheese, and or ground beef or ground pork. But then you can make pickles out of it, or breads, or pies even. Some people have used them in salads, even kind of as a relish too. So it's really pretty. Oh, soups! Forget about soups. So it's pretty versatile. It's I sometimes feel like in Forrest Gump when they're talking about shrimp.
So the question is: so we almost lost melitol because, well, you know, we lose track with our traditions. Right. Grocery stores change how we perceive what we eat and. And the fact that many of us got out of the garden and got into the grocery store meant that traditions like melitol were nearly lost. We almost lost the fruits themselves, not so much. I mean, we had those fruits down in the Caribbean, as you say, but we didn't have the fruits that were well adapted to our daylight hours and to our growing conditions. So David has been really instrumental in helping to sort of build a renaissance of our native strains, I'll call them native, our local cultivars of melitol. And David, this year may have presented some challenges. What was your, what happened?
Well, in my particular area, my yard, I've been growing the ones I got from an old family friend for 14 years, and we got to name it Boudreaux Robert. So that's the one I grow. And last year we had the heat dome issue. But usually what happens, you will start these as the fruit. They'll sprout, and you'll either pot them, let them get a good root ball, and put them in the ground by, say, April. And then once you got them growing through April, they usually thrive pretty well. And then they kind of hit a wall when August hits with the oppressive heat we have along the Gulf Coast. So oftentimes we've been recommending you put some shade cloth if you don't already have a partially shaded area. And then you don't want to overwater them because they get that, you know, basically you drown the roots. So you got to be very careful. It's got to be a good balance. And then if you make it through to the beginning of September, you'll start to see it flower and get buds. Now, for us this year, the problem was we had that long period of lack of rain, basically a drought. And so a lot of people who had done well last year lost theirs to the just the excessive heat. You could almost not water it enough to keep up. In some of those cases, those people did not have a proper shade protection. Mine's underneath a big canopy of a red oak. And so I've had 6 or 7 vines underneath there, but some of my younger vines that I planted last year or the year before, who really weren't that far along, didn't make it. But my main vine and about 3 others have done well as far as growth. But I had a lot of blooms. I had a lot of or buds, I should say, and had the hope that I was going to have a pretty decent crop. But one of the things that I think may have inhibited mine is that I've got the nice street light that I have had out there for years.
Oh, heavens to Betsy. Goodness gracious.
So what we found out is that it seemed like it inhibited the ability for it to know that it needs to start blooming. So I started turning that off, and I got a couple of Melitol come on, but not the 100 numbers. I might get 1 or 2. So, like I said, it's a marathon and not a sprint with Melitol growing.
Yeah, so that's an important thing. So these are very light-sensitive plants, and that's perfectly – that's fine. That's how they deal with Caribbean. That's how they know when to flower. It's how they know when to fruit. And so if you even have a strong street light shining on them – it can inhibit their, it will delay their flowering. And this is true for a lot of plants. It's true for poinsettias. It's true for a lot of those, for Christmas cactus and lots of other plants that are basically sensitive to sunlight and may respond by blooming to the number of hours of night that they sense. So it's a really important thing. The other David, we're coming up on now. We're thinking about next year and how's next year going to do? What are you doing for your vines? They can be perennial and mobile, and yours have been pretty regularly perennial. You've had yours in the same place for, what'd you say, 14 years?
Right. Now, I was going to say, I will add that even though my vine hadn't done well, I did get a different variety that I have shared with some folks that have done fairly well in Washington County, and they're growing them out of Pensacola, which they got from Cutoff, Louisiana. They're called Papa Sylvest, and they're a little bit bigger than the one I've got. So they've had some moderate, 2 dozen that they've picked this year as first-time growers. Or second-time growers. So they've done fairly well up there. And, in fact, somebody I even read bought one to Huntsville, and I guess they're babying it because they got one Melitol off of it. But typically it'll be interesting to see what they do through the winter. But what I would do normally is when we start getting that 30-degree temperature that's going to last several days, I will cut my vine back to about 2 inches. And cover it with either straw or just oak leaves, and maybe a little tarp over it if it's going to rain a lot, just to kind of keep it protected from any hard freezes. you could try to cover it, but it just takes a lot of work, and it depends on how much time you've got to save to try to keep it through the winter.
Yeah. Yes, and it's good, and they're much easier to keep going through the winter, I would say, than bananas, for example.
Yeah.
I think they're pretty easy, and I think the leaf bag thing can work again because those leaf bags heat up, and so I'll have to say, plastic bags filled with leaves. I'll have to say, when I talk about leaf bags, that's all it means. It's whatever your neighbors are putting out on the street, and they will help to keep things warm. When you cut a stalk, and David's right about this, it allows an entry point for water. And it's something you have to think about with a lot of plants. And consequently, the water gets into the stem and expands and contracts and freezes the stem and can do damage. So for that reason, it can be useful to protect the stalk from excess moisture. And David, that's interesting. You put it over the top. I might even just put it over the stalk itself. You see what I'm saying?
What?
To keep
that would work.
And then put your leaf bags over that, which would keep it a little warmer. But I would say in many winters, and this may be one of those winters, who knows? You might have a melaton survive even without that extra protection.
Right. I was going to say that one philosophy that we're thinking about to combat the heat is if we get the crops like these Papa Sylvester and some that are available, if you get it sprouted now, planted in the beginning of fall or winter, so if you plant it in the next month directly in the dirt, you may be able to overwinter it. We'll talk back after the break. I'll tell you more.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? We'll repeat that when we come right back, sure. David.
You get Plain Talk on Plain Living. Let's talk about living and growing in the Deep South with Bill Finch. Call 251-343-0106 on FM Talk 106.5.
Yeah, I feel bad. Somebody asked me this question about this evergreen or golden thread evergreen that they planted, and it didn't look like the specimen they saw in Virginia. I just looked at the pictures a little more carefully. It's Chamaecyprus, however people want to pronounce it, Pacifera. It's a type of cypress, threadleaf golden cypress. It is not generally recommended for the Gulf Coast. I think you'll have a hard time. I will tell you that it's going to take a long time for those plants to become specimens. They are very slow growing. It will take them a long time to develop that central leader that's going to give it that cone shape. So if it does well, wait about 10 years and it'll look better. David, we're talking about melaton, and you said something very interesting. Let's say it again, because we got interrupted by the music. You were saying that with some of these newer varieties that people are trying out, it's so impressive that they're doing well in Washington County, away from the coast like that.
Yeah, so I mean, this is actually an old the Papa Sylvester is grown by a gentleman named Butch Ogeron out in, I think, around Cutoff, Louisiana. He's been growing it. His grandfather was growing it. Butch appears to be in his 60s or 70s. So it's an old variety. But it seems to be pretty hardy. And Elizabeth Eubanks with the From the Ground Up Community Garden in Pensacola got some, and they've done well with theirs. But I've given the ones that I've had, the Boudreaux Robert, to the folks up in Washington County, and they did okay, but they never got any fruit. But this year, when they tried the Papa Sylvester, they seemed to do much better, and obviously they got yields. Somebody has tried it three other times. This is his first year that he actually got something that he can eat. So they not saying that that's the only hardy variety, but that's one of the ones that seems to be doing well right now. But the point about growing them further inland is that because of the susceptibility of the hurricanes and the winds and the floods, you know, if we can get some inland growers, that helps keep these varieties, these heirlooms, Louisiana heirlooms, as we call them, going strong. And one of the theories that we said is that if you can get them to sprout now, and then we have a mild winter like we have or predicting to have, if you can get them in the ground, get them started growing, put the leaf bags around them like you're suggesting, then you have a 3 to 6 month start on some growth that you would not normally have if you just put them in the traditional method of in a paper bag and let them sprout and then plant in the spring. Plus, you have a better chance of actually getting a spring crop, which I failed to mention before, because you still have the shorter days and the longer nights, you could actually get on mature plants a second crop. So that's something we're suggesting folks try to do going forward, especially this year. And then the plant will be hardier and make it through the hot heat of the summer and then hopefully do better in the fall.
Yeah, yeah. And so starting them, I mean, would you start them in August or September? Is that when you might want them to sprout? Can you get them to sprout at that time?
Well,
it's really hard to do that.
You're not going to have any until, like, right now.
Right.
So if you get sprouted now, then the thought would be is once you get it a pretty good sprout on it, just put it in the dirt or in a pot and then put it in the dirt as soon as possible. A well-drained area, like I said, partial shade seems to work well with a fairly decent canopy that you can protect it. But, yeah, the earliest you probably could get it is probably November, late November. Into the ground.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, good, good. Well, that's interesting, and good thought. So, you did get some fruit started this spring, didn't I hear you say that you had some this? Didn't you?
Well, from the spring, last spring, I ended up getting some from that garden in Pensacola.
Pensacola.
I had one or two that I had. From last year. I didn't have a good yield last year either, but the vines are doing well. But the ones from Pensacola, I started and I was able to get out to the folks.
Yeah, so, I was thinking maybe you actually had some vines that fruited last spring. It seems like I remember you're telling me.
I think
this,
I did. But I had one or two. I did have, but yeah, I only got one or two off of that.
Right.
And so I think part of the deal may go back to when we're talking with the sunlight or the street light, is that, you know, you think about the fall or early fall here, we have a lot of beautiful days, which is great from being outside. But from a standpoint of, I think with more overcast days, it may have actually helped promote flowering as well because you didn't have as much sunlight. So I think that this year what I'm learning is that maybe I just need to turn that light off and or put a shade up to protect a little bit more from that street light and its effects on the blooming.
Yeah, that's right. That's why we put poinsettias in closets. You remember the old thing? People used to put a poinsettia in a closet and to get it to bloom. You actually don't have to put it in a closet, but you do have to be aware of the extent of light. And, you know, I try to remember, it's about what we're actually looking for, about 12-hour days, I think. Is that right?
Yeah, you start seeing the sprouting around September 21st. I mean, that's the sprouting, the flowering around September 21st around here. A little earlier.
14, maybe sometimes. It's 12, between 12 and 14-hour days is when they start sprouting, I think.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And then this time of year, of course, the daylight is down to, we're getting down to around 10 hours.
Right.
And that's where it'll hover through December. And that really encourages flowering among these guys, but it's too cold.
Right.
So it's so that's the trick. So David, other things that we have, it's been a while. So any other things real quickly that you've been experimenting with this year in terms of Gulf Coast foodways?
Not as much. I got busy with a family history project that took pretty much all my summer. I do have a variety of butter beans that I got from the guy in Washington Parish that are black-eyed butter beans. It looks like a black-eyed pea, but a butter bean in shape. I haven't actually tasted them yet because I'm trying to get enough accumulated to taste those. But they're growing pretty well.
Yeah, I will tell you, David, that I planted black-eyed butter beans this year, by the way.
Okay.
Just a coincidence. And, well, I've been planting for a couple of years. This year was, I finally did it right and put them in a good place. They are delicious. They are particularly good. They had a very sweet flavor. They don't need a lot of cooking. They were absolutely wonderful.
And, did you cook them with any particular meats or anything?
No, I didn't, because I like the flavor of them. So what I did was I parboil them just a little bit. Mm-hmm. And then I'll make usually a pepper, garlic, maybe onion, but usually pepper and garlic with a few other spices in oil. And then I will, after I've parboiled them, parboiling may not be the word, boil them for about 3 to 5 minutes. Then I put them in a skillet with the oil and the peppers and garlic and stir fry them, and they're absolutely delicious. You could add mushrooms, too. You could add bacon. You don't want to add too much because the flavor is so good. They're really quite good.
I can't wait to try
mine. Yeah, yeah. Oh, David, it's always good to talk to you. Thank you. Thank you. We should do this more often. Folks, it's good to talk with all of you. We'll be back next week, I reckon. Because everything is on the phone, you know.